I know we're still sort of getting everyone in and things like that this morning, which is great. If you haven't had your coffee, let's get some coffee. My name is Brandon Kelly. This is Roger Gilchrist. I am a senior solution architect with Microsoft. I specifically work in the CRM engineering team. I do two or three different things, but the most important thing you need to know is I live in the world of make it better, make it faster, and make it run really well.
Well, I'm similar. I work in the same team as Brandon, part of the R&D. But we both work directly with customers. So this is coming from real-world experience, not kind of theory of this. But we're going to talk about some of the things that we've seen from the field, some of the things we're doing to try and help address those.
Fantastic. So everyone's in the right room, correct? Nobody's like, this wasn't the AX session I signed up for? All right, fantastic. All right. Just in case you're not sure, why am I here? It's kind of this simple. Everyone's moving to the cloud, right? Like, that's a thing your business has been talking to you about for a little while. If you're not already there, just sort of show of hands, who's running online today, CRM online? All right, quite a few of you. Who's thinking about it? Like, running on-prem and looking to do that. Okay, great. And so because of that demand, right, this idea that we're sort of need to be connected over the internet, connectivity becomes sort of a challenge. It's a key ingredient in making sure that we stay performant, that things stay fast. And if there's anything our businesses want us to do, it's to make sure that things stay really fast. So we're here to sort of talk about that and work through some of the challenges with that. This is a little different than the things we've been doing in the past, right? It's always been about sort of what we take care of inside of the corporate network, the umbrella of the things we control. And so now all of a sudden we're in the world of the things you don't control, right? The public network and things like that. And so the corporate network, the things we're doing there, may not have been scaled out to be of the same size or order of magnitude. And so there's some things like that that we have to change our thinking about. Online, our CRM product online, like, it does its part with this, like, in that we've taken a whole lot of steps to address those challenges, to sort of look at what it looks like when we have intermittent connectivity, what it means to have sort of occasionally connected systems talking to each other. So we're very vested in that as a product group, as our development. We keep thinking about what we do and how we continue to optimize. And the best thing that we can do that we tell our customers about is, hey, there's three things you need to make CRM work really well. The first is you need a great connection, like, on your network. Like, that has to be a reliable, durable thing that just always works. The second thing is you need a really great database. If the database isn't working, then CRM's not working. We take care of that for you and online. And the third is you need a really great partner. This is sort of the ingredients I tell people, like, this is what you have to do to have a really successful CRM implementation. You need someone to help you out. So a little bit about performance. Just show of hands, like, who here is working on online today and has said, man, we've got some performance issues I'm looking to tackle? I would be surprised if people didn't raise their hands to that question.
I'd also be surprised if you're here.
Right. No doubt. So what's up with that, right? That's a question that people ask all the time. What are the right things that I need to make sure we have that? Well, it really starts with designing the right implementation, so that's a big part of it. Was this built in such a way that we're leveraging the product in an efficient manner? Did we take the process that we actually need to optimize, and we bring that to the software and match that in the correct way? And surprisingly, that doesn't happen a lot. So anyone here migrate from another system to CRM? Did they migrate from another system from one of our diamond sponsors here? Okay. There we go. So if you did that, there's a lot of this. It's lift and shift, right? Like, hey, let's take the thing we did in the old one and make it work like that. And that works sometimes if the design principles that we had sort of taken into account say that it works the same way. If we didn't, you sort of took something that was really written with one goal in mind and tried to put it into another system, and it works with a different goal. So the design piece is very considerable. Doing that will be a big part of making sure that it's performant. The second is sort of about coding for efficiency, and this is the one we always think about. So we think about performance and stuff. Everyone wants to talk to the dev. Any devs in the room? Sorry. I'm sorry that everyone wants to say it's your fault when it's not performant. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's about that. Other times it's not, right? And so we have to sort of make sure that each time you do that, and what I tell people is it's a butterfly effect, right? So if you're one line of code here in the wrong place, it could mean a whole host of problems over here on the output of that. So coding for efficiency is a big thing. And third ingredient in that same story is testing. Testing, testing, testing. Show of hands, who here does load testing on their software as a whole? Only a handful, right? And then keep them up if you do load testing with CRM online. You had a PFE help you with this? Okay. You'll probably want a little help from Microsoft to do something like that. What happens if you start load testing Serum online without someone knowing about it? You're using a cloud-based service, so what does that look like to us on the other end? Well, it looks like a DDoS attack. Looks like you're trying to figure out how to attack and compromise our servers. That's how we see it on the other end. We're like, what are all these requests coming in for? And so it sort of sets off some alarms and triggers on us, so you want to coordinate those activities with us online. We do have a process for that. You can do that through our support apparatus. And so making sure we're testing for both performance and reliability is sort of a key ingredient here. It's one thing to design it well, it's another thing to code it well, but we need a net that goes underneath it when we fail at both of those things, which we do from time to time. We need some way to measure it, to understand what's going to happen. And the last ingredient there is building a support apparatus that's designed around the idea of performance. And this is really about the service layer. This is about the connectivity. This is about the response. This is about the measurement, the how you're going to say what is performant and what is not performant, and having that correct definition sort of across your business to say this is what our users need, this is what our business needs, this is how we measure it, this is how we know when we're not there. And so that support mechanism is sort of key in this. Those are the four big ingredients that will say you can be performant or you can not be performant. The second advice I give people sort of around this is once we have the process, once we have the tools, once we have the measurement, all of that is sort of in sync. How do I understand when I don't have something that's performant? Like, how do I measure it and how do I break that problem down? And there's sort of two approaches people talk about. First is top down, and the second is bottom up. Sort of a hand, show of hands, who prefers this top down approach? I'll describe it afterwards, but you've heard of this before. This is what you like. Okay, not a person. One of you. All right, perfect. So top down works like this. I'm going to start at the thing closest to the user, the software itself, the web tier, the browser, the thing that you're controlling, whatever that is, and I'm going to find my problem there. If I don't, I'll keep digging down until I see it. Bottom up goes the other way, where I'm going to start with the data, the furthest thing away from the user, and sort of figure my problem there. And truthfully, we could have the next 45 minutes of this conversation could just be about pros and cons of each approach. Brandon says, this is my opinion, top down is the best way to go. I do a lot of this type of problem solving, and so handled it both ways, and this is the one that's most consistent. So we talk about sort of what to do with a top-down approach. When I want to look at a perf problem, how do I do that? Well, start with the thing closest to the end user, and that's usually the app, the browser, as it were. Start with Fiddler or the browser's F12 debug tools. Those are your sort of first tools to find a problem. Show of hands here, who's used Fiddler? Great, quite a few of you. So you know that's a pretty useful tool. Fiddler's only as good as your ability to understand what you're examining with it, though. And so what you need to sort of look at next is, okay, how many requests were they? Like, what was the series of execution? Were they async or sync? Like, was one taking longer than the next because we were waiting on a dependency between them? And what's the browser doing? What's the browser's behavior? Because it's not just requesting the data. It's doing layout. It's doing caching. It's doing screen refreshes. It's doing all these other things. So all of that sort of plays into it. When we talk about connectivity, though, it really will be about the number of requests and the timing between them. Like, that's the thing we're going to want to look at very carefully. The next two are sort of things that aren't as apropos for this talk, but they do relate to performance. So if you've done all your checks on the app and things are good there, everything's great with the client, then it sort of goes to the next place. Like, what's the client talking to? It sort of goes to the server. And so we tell people, like, let's start eliminating some variables for online. So let's take the UI away from this. Like, if we can't see the problem there, we can't relate it to what's going on in the browser, let's take the browser out of the equation for a minute and reproduce the same thing. Do we still have a failure? If we do, then we sort of know it's on the server end. Some of that's things that you control as a consumer, right? So plugins, workflows, that sort of thing. What is the execution chain for the thing I'm trying to do? And we have to sort of look at that holistically. So if you get through all that, and you're like, still don't have my problem, well, then it comes to data. Like, we go to the next one, that's the bottom layer. And again, things that are in your control from a design consideration would be security models. And Roger here is an expert on the topic. So there's a white paper. It's all about scalable security modeling with dynamic CRM. Show of hands if you've seen that white paper. This man is the gentleman who figured that out. So he's the guy to talk to about things like that. But avoid those sort of complex scenarios when you can, and sort of look for simplicity. And that's the basic rule of thumb. There are some.
And just a great test on that people often miss is if you suspect it might be, try it with an admin. If you try it with an admin user that bypasses all the security, that and that suddenly goes faster, you've got a fair indication that's what's behind a lot of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I know at least one person in this room has had that experience, so we've been through that. If you get through all that and you still don't quite have it, well, then it's time to call us, right? Because we are controlling some portion of the data for you online. We're sort of taking care of that, and we're happy to work with you on those scenarios through our support channel. We have a lot of discipline around that, and so we can do things like put some indexing in or poke a plan guide in where we have to and some things like that, and we've been able to do that for customers to sort of help them on the data side. So a little bit about connecting. A lot of challenges sort of in the connectivity model. Like, the first one is really sort of, you've got this connection between bespoke networks or potentially a centralized network, the LAN. You've got the WAN, and then you've got the rest of the internet to go through. So if anyone here wanted to guess, like, what do you think the average is number of hops between your corporate network and a Microsoft property? Like, 10? 10's a pretty good number. It's somewhere in between 6 and about 15, depending on where you are and sort of where the property is and what exactly you're trying to get to. About 4 of those hops happen inside of our network, depending on which data center you're going to and what's going on. Azure will sort of route. Our aggregate time for most of North America is less than about 17 milliseconds. It's about the amount of time it takes us from where you get to our edge network to actually pin you to a CRM server and deliver you through. Your results may vary depending on exactly where you are and sort of how close you are to our edge and some things like that. But we've taken that. So we suggest, like our recommendation, what we put in support is we want you to have 150 milliseconds of latency or less. So what's 150 milliseconds? Like, that's not a very sizable amount of time. Doesn't seem like that's a hard number to beat. Most of your corporate connectivity is going to sit in the world of probably 20 to 50 milliseconds in most scenarios. But 150 seems very achievable until I need to go over the Atlantic, until I need to jump a pond, right? Or until I'm on an occasionally connected cell network, or until my boss is on hotel Wi-Fi and is like, why is this not working well? Or until you're at a conference. And you're doing it over here. And you're like, man, what's going on? I don't understand why 24,000 people can't share the Wi-Fi at the same time with 6 devices each. So you have to sort of look at each one of these components and make sure that we're sort of optimizing at each one. And that's where it's all about sort of breaking it down and saying what's what. Show of hands here if you've heard of an application platform called Thousand Eyes. Fantastic. If you work with our support on some of these things, we have two programs. One is a partnership with Thousand Eyes where we can sort of, one, we can do outside-in network analysis, right? So we can sort of, Thousand Eyes is sort of an apparatus with thousands of little listening points all across the internet that can all alert and feed us some telemetry data about what the internet's up to. And that's sort of an amazing thing when you think about it, and that's why they call it Thousand Eyes, because they've got eyes everywhere. And so we can sort of say, like, hey, yeah, you're having an issue routing from A to B over the public internet, and it looks like this ISP is the problem in your way. Like, we should talk to your ISP about giving you a static route from A to B over this network and not the other one, right? And it lets us get that type of analysis. And we can do that here, and we can also give you sort of a free apparatus if you work with us where you can get a deployment of Thousand Eyes, put that on your network, and it can feed us telemetry data about what's going on there so we can even further pinpoint the problem. So if it goes behind your network, we can get that. So remember that, like I said, it's about breaking down the problem. Usually the optimizations come in the same style. So we have to do the same thing. We sort of take each individual component, and we sort of optimize. There's no single answer that's like, hey, here's how it gets really fast for you. It's usually sort of a combination of small things. So here's a couple of these challenges, right? The first is sort of LAN connectivity and what's going on with that. So let's just take this scenario where I've got office in Dublin, office in Frankfurt, we've got a bunch of other branch offices, we've got corporate backbone, we've got the public internet, we've got Microsoft data center. And all these things to get from a branch office to Microsoft data center are going to take a lot of hops. This is, somebody had said 10, like I said, it's somewhere usually between 6 and 15, depending on what you're doing. And so you'll see there's a convergence point, sort of right in the middle, where we start over here, and we have a lot of latency inside of here, and then it doesn't converge until the very end, right? Until you get close enough to our data center, do you actually get on the same path? And so any small hiccup in any one of those little blue dots on the screen right now is sort of a failure point. It's a place where things start to go slower. So this scenario, we're sort of looking at this, at the client. We're going to start with the things that you can control inside the LAN. Similarly, You have challenges on the WAN. So a lot of scenarios. Who here is sort of working for a corporate entity where you have a hub and spoke network scenario? So things are getting routed through a single channel at some point. Every office gets connected through a site-to-site VPN to one hub and then goes through the WAN. Nobody? Okay. All right, well, if you have this, there exists lots of challenges on the WAN side too, and usually it'll be at that convergence point. It's at the place where your LAN connectivity bridges into WAN connectivity, like that'll usually be a choke point, and a place where sort of large amounts of latency will be introduced. Latency is part of it, but bandwidth is a huge part too, and this is actually usually a part where bandwidth starts to suffer as well, and so you'll see it there. Then we have the internet. And that is a big challenge, too. And this is the one that is usually not something you get to really control. Like, the internet is what the internet is, right? And so show of hands here if your network topology consists of an MPLS connection. Handful of you. So MPLS is sort of a cool thing because it gives you two things. One, it gives you what we call kind of layer 2.5. Gives you four very specific bytes in every frame that goes through it, and that those sets of bytes let you do with this one thing, quality of service. They let you route over the internet and say, hey, these packets take priority over these packets. That's basically what MPLS is. The side effect of this is that most carriers who offer MPLS networks will offer you route optimization over the internet, which is kind of a nice thing. They'll allow you to do static routing and things like that so that you can optimize your workload, your traffic, the way you need to. Generally, this is not something you get a lot of control over. Roger's going to talk a little bit about ways we can get more control and sort of how to handle the challenge of the internet. And usually it's about inefficient routing. It's the number of hops you're taking over public networks that you don't get to control. The last is sort of a security thing related to the same thing. Once we start routing over the public network, we're routing over the internet, how do we ensure that man-in-the-middle attacks and things like that don't happen, right? Like, because we're now going from A to B through many middlemen, and when we do that, we're offering each one an opportunity to interrupt and intercept what we're doing. Most of that's usually handled by certificate-based authentication. We're using SSL to sort of guarantee, hey, the bytes as we encrypted at point A arrive at destination B, unmodified from the way we had intended for them to go. Anyone here just maybe have their security people, or maybe they were working through, maybe they're doing this project and they disabled TLS 1.2 and TLS 2.0 and prior versions of SSL? You should have, because if you didn't, like, you've got a security vulnerability. The thing you think is secure is not secure, and in fact, it can be compromised to the man in the middle. I was reading something, like, just 2 days ago about this, that, like, close to 70% of the internet's SSL-enabled traffic is still using lower versions of the protocol, like have not upgraded. One of the last challenges we look at sort of at the application layer is what is the software doing, right? Because we talked about what's 150 milliseconds, like it doesn't seem like a very long amount of time to wait. So it really kind of comes down to how many times am I waiting that amount of time? How responsive are we? And the software is doing a lot of things. It's not just talking back and forth over the network, it's also talking to the browser and say, browser, do things, lay out things. It's also talking to the server and say, server, go get me data, and there's compute cycles there. So in the world of performance, like, we're optimizing to sub-millisecond. Like, that's how it works. I once went through about 2.5 weeks of work to figure out how to squeeze 2.6 milliseconds out of a transaction. Like, how do I get 2.6 milliseconds less? And someone had said, man, that seems like overkill. Like, why are we doing this? And I'm like, no, the way we win perf is through lots of small 2.6 milliseconds optimizations. Like, there's not a single answer. So we end up sort of doing a bunch of these and hope it adds up to enough. And the reason we do this is because of the chattiness. Because it's not just 2.6 milliseconds, it's 2.6 milliseconds per request. And one page load might be 10 requests. So that's 26 milliseconds per user, and there might be 1,000 users doing it. And so we sort of look at that whole thing in aggregate and we say that micro really adds up. We have to be careful and pay attention to the small results because they're going to aggregate and add up to something very substantial. So you want to look at the chattiness. Show of hands here if you've taken a look at Fiddler and you've taken a look at CRM Online in Fiddler. Handful of you. What'd you find out? Well, you probably found out it's very chatty. Right, there's a lot of requests that go through, and so when we talk about what's happening inside the client and its behavior, we talk about two scenarios. We call them cold and warm loading scenarios. Cold is the idea that we haven't cached anything, it's your first time load. And so it's a lot chattier in that scenario. The average CRM form on a cold load will be somewhere between 20 and 35 requests. Right, that's how it's going to go. Warm loads are not so much. Like after it's been initialized and we've gotten things like the command bar cached and all the layout cache for the form and a bunch of things like that, like it's about 3 or 4 requests typically for the same form to continue to reload. But that cold load scenario is one that we continually look to optimize. There's some things we're doing inside of our product to make sure that we get really good at that. So I'll say like one of those things that we're looking at that we're doing is CDN delivery, which gives us the ability to sort of give you some of that static stuff on a network that's much closer to where you are, regardless of where you are related to the CRM server you're talking to. And we shaved off about 15 to 20% of our performance issue on sort of loading cold scenarios by doing that, just by moving to a web server that's closer to you. There's a lot of sort of optimizations like that that we're making behind the scenes to sort of make that transparent. But the chattiness is something that we really care about. Anyone here sort of say, okay, you've explained the cold thing and the warm thing to me, and I don't think I care too much about the cold thing. Like, who minds if that's happening once a day per user? Like, the first request is slow and the rest of it's... Does anyone see that as not a problem? I know you don't see that as not a problem. All right, good, because it is a problem, because it's not just once a day. It's about once an hour, typically. You're going to face that, and so... we have to sort of work through what that looks like and how we best optimize on things like that. So here's just sort of an example of a cold load. And I couldn't fit the whole thing on the slide. So if that helps you, there are actually more requests that go past the fiddler trace on the right. But at that point, it started to squeeze together so much that the picture was so distorted you couldn't see it anymore. So he said, well, this will have to do. What I want to show you is sort of we're loading up to 6 or 8 of these in parallel at any given point in time. And after we do that, they sort of start to aggregate on top of each other. And so you'll see a couple of these are going to be long running. Like one of these is layout. Like, so you'll see that closer to the bottom, there's one that says layout.aspx. And that's one of the things we'll cache, right? And that's the definition for how the form is laid out and what's going on there. Like those types of requests, we want to make sure that we optimize the best we can. Again, in these cold loads, we're going to see a lot of these requests. Our rules on bandwidth that we say our bandwidth should be at least 50 kilobytes a second. Our latency should be 150 milliseconds or less. I'm going to tell you that those are minimums. Like those are sort of the worst case scenario numbers for you. You should be beating those by a considerable amount. And if you're not, like the experience will certainly indicate so. Just out of a show of hands again, I'm going to list off some numbers, and I want you to tell me if your benchmark says your form should load in this time or less. We'll start high. I'll start with 15 seconds. Who's got the bar at 15 seconds? That would be okay. Nobody. How about 10? 5? Copy at 5. 3? Most of you at 3. 2? 1? Yeah, okay. Less than 1? I need to put you back in the world of reality for just a moment. Less than one is not a thing that we really get to do. So I will tell you that we optimize to about 3. That's the number that we're looking at and saying sort of this, we feel like we got to a place where we're really comfortable with that. And when our customers come to me and says, man, I really want that to be 2, I start to have a debate about semantics as to what a second really means. But as soon as we get through that, if we can get it to about 3, that's a target that I think that we're pretty good with, that we can feel all right about. So consider some of these variables, because they all influence things. Like, do you have that same expectation within the same region or across the region? Because I just gave you a number and said we sort of target 3. 3 seconds is what we expect. But if you tell me, hey, I've got people on a CRM server in EMEA, in Europe, and my team is working in China, in Asia, my number just went to 15. That's the number you should be targeting, not 3. People say, why? Like, well, one, getting the data all the way over the ocean into Asia, or particularly to a lot of public routes the other way, is going to add a lot of latency to each request. The second is that China's got this thing called the Great Firewall. Anyone here have to work with that? They should call it the slowest firewall, not the Great Firewall. And it will add a considerable amount of time. So the latency number that I gave you of 150 milliseconds or less, what do you think the average customer in China has for latency? It's somewhere between 400 and 600 milliseconds. So it's taking a half a second just for us to agree to have a conversation, right? Just for network connection on A to connect to B is one half of a second. And we're doing that 10 to 30 times per page load, right, depending on the scenario. So you have to consider sort of what your use case scenario is and maybe adjust and calibrate on some numbers there a little bit. The China one's sort of an extreme example. There are simpler examples, though. Consider the distance you're traversing and traveling. And Roger, we'll talk a little bit more about this as we sort of get through that. But consider the location. So where you decide to have your CRM instance located is very much something that you're going to want to calculate. And so if you're like, let's say, going into Asia, our data centers, sometimes in the US, can offer you sort of a better routing scheme and sort of better access to both Europe and Asia than Europe could, right? And it sort of kind of goes down to where is your workload sort of one, the most impactful, like we care about performance the most in this location, so this is a thing. And the second is sort of where people are and where it'll be affected. There's some things we're doing that are going to help us optimize this for multi-geo scenarios in the future. We're not there today, so today you host a tenant in one region, you sort of say, this is where I want my CRM to be. In the future, that may not be so solidified. We may be able to work through scenarios where it's like we want one plus another, and we want you to replicate and do some work for us. And so I'll just tell you that the schemes there are very complicated. Getting through those problems are really complicated. So today we say, customer, we have to look at compliance and sort of where you are and where you need us to be. So some of the things that we see all the time, we'll see the poor routing problem. Like, hey, we're, and oftentimes, sometimes that's over the internet. Like I said, if you go with like an MPLS connection or work with a specific type of ISP, they can help you with routing over the internet and those issues. But oftentimes you'll see the routing issue, it usually starts in the corporate network. Like, we've been through a number of these scenarios where they'll say, help, your product, your platform is really slow, and we sort of get through some of that activity, and next thing I know, I've put some agents inside their network, and we said, hey, you've got an office in Chicago, you've got another one in London, you've got another one in San Francisco, and to get from Chicago to Texas, where we need you to go, like, you went to London and San Francisco and back, right? What's going on with that? And they say, we had no idea that was happening. And all of a sudden, some network guy will get on and say, man, my configuration was perfect. What happened? Anyone ever meet a network guy who had a configuration that they didn't say was perfect? So it's never my config, man. That config was perfect.
We've checked our network. We know it's fine. It's normally the frozen.
That's right. And they'll say it and we'll say, well, hey, look, the data shows us this. And the cool part is with an appliance like ThousandEyes, I don't just get to show them the data. I get to show them a map. And a picture really is worth a thousand words. And I'm like, look, we need to go from here to here, but it goes here, here, and here, and then it gets to where we need it to be. And so that matters. So routing is going to be a very significant thing. Half of that is something you really get to control. Half you may not get to. Let's take control of the thing you can do. Proxies are sort of another thing. They'll represent a choke point pretty often. So we'll see sort of proxies. And usually this is about compliance and wanting to make sure that, you know, people are surfing the internet for the right things. We say, hey, look, trust us on this. Like, your cloud property, the thing you're expecting to run your business, should be on the whitelist, the things we don't care too much about having a proxy through. The client configuration itself, so the Windows configuration, we look at the maximum number of concurrent requests, the window scaling. Jumbo frames can sometimes actually play into this, but there's a whole other thing to stomach jumbo frames. But these are things that we can optimize on the client, and we look to do so. And then the last is sort of a lack of caching. So any number of organizations have sent us this. Anyone here work for financial services or insurance? I'm talking to you guys, or you. Here it is. Browser cache is a thing. We need that. That has to be turned on. I know it represents some sort of security risk to your security team because they're going to say, man, some information about what you're surfing on the internet is getting written to disk. But we need that to exist. Like, that has to be turned on. Because when we can't cache anything, every request is a cold load. Every time. Every time we go in. So you have the worst possible scenario every access, every time. So I targeted FinServ, I'm sorry, and insurance for this because they're the most likely candidates to have turned this off.
normally to do with we can't store customer data in the cache,
right,
which is still a perception back from 20 years ago where people did do that sort of thing. We're storing static metadata. We're not storing any customer data. No one else does either because their application will be shut down if they're doing it. So it's a perceived security risk, not a real one.
Right. So we have to optimize the things that are really slow. A lot of the time, we don't have to do that on the LAN. Like, your on-prem applications can get away with a lot of things. When everything's 100 megabit or a gigabit connection across your network, you care a little less about some sloppiness and bandwidth and some things like that. When your latency is 10 milliseconds, you're like, yeah, so what? It's all right. It's not that big of a deal to make that request 100 times. But when that's not the case anymore, when each network request is sort of subject to a little bit of slowness, we have to really optimize every part of that. So distance really will amplify the problem. To do this, we talk about chunking versus chatty. So CRM's a little bit chatty at the moment. Like the product sort of opens up a lot of connections. We saw the Fidler graph over there. We're doing a lot of work not just on sort of the CDN side too, but we continuously look at sort of how we chunk this together a little better. And so we can sort of say, let's have more conversations over the same connection. And the analogy I like to give people is just imagine you're at a dinner party where every 6 seconds you have to get up and go to another table. How much rich conversation did you get to have in 6 seconds? You sat down and you said, hey, my name is Brandon and I gotta go. And you're off to the next one. And so we say, let's stick around for a little longer than 6 seconds. Let's stay at that same table for 30 seconds or a minute and maybe we can have a better conversation. And so there's some of this we control in our product. There's a whole lot of this you control in your customizations. So show of hands here, who's got some devs working on web resources or writing some JavaScript to extend our application? That's right. If they're doing that, they are almost certainly using our web API and our OData endpoint to do so, because there's very little you can do in scripting that would offer a lot of value to your company without having to go back to CRM and have a conversation. And so for those developers, we say this, hey, optimize and be chunky. Like, do the thing we didn't do for you and make sure you're having that conversation where you get all the data you need sort of in one trip wherever possible. So we look for that. There's another scenario. Who's got someone who's maybe a business analyst who took a look at CRM and said, man, this is awesome. Let's design this form. I'm going to put 250 fields on it and 14 subgrids. Like, this is a thing I want to do. I want all the data in one place. Each one loads, and only 6 to 8 can load at one particular point in time. That's it. So we have to wait for a few of them to finish. So what do you do when we do that? Well, we say, hey, let's simplify the form design. Do you really need 14 grids on here, or is this sort of the thing you wanted? Can we break this into multiple forms and have you sort of switch through at that scenario? Can we collapse and hide some of these? And so we're doing some optimizations on our end to sort of make that subgrid experience a little better, to allow you to be a little sloppier. But even after we do that, I'm still going to recommend to people that they take a careful look at this, because it's really, from just a business perspective, you have a lot of clutter when you start to do that. There's a lot of data on the screen, and it's hard to know what you're supposed to look at and what you're not. So there's, in addition to the performance piece, there's also sort of a business impact consideration to make.
There's another very common scenario we see, which is we do things like ribbon bars, which need to come up before the rest of the form is available. We've got privileges that allow you for us to control that in a really, really good way, a really efficient way. The number of times we've seen people say, well, I'm going to use security roles. I don't want to use a privilege. Oh, wait, we don't provide a mechanism for that, so I need to make a web service call from the ribbon to get the security roles to decide whether to offer it. And as Brandon says, what does that do? It introduces a round trip while the form's blocking. Right. So one of the worst case scenarios we see of this is 3 or 4 requests, which we see in Fidler, coming back asking for security roles, blocking the whole form up. So again, it's those kind of things which really impact. So it's not just the time of the request, but what impact it's having on the rest of the UI while it's doing it.
Yep, absolutely. So sort of the last thing on this is what's happening on the server with each request. So if you've optimized your request pattern, all the stuff going on to the client, you've done sort of as much of that as you can, it's time to take a look at what's happening on the server. So who here has written a plugin for CRM, or they have a plugin written? Keep your hand up if you've written a retrieve or retrieve multiple plugin. All right, I'm talking to you now. So here's the thing about that. Every time I want to get data, I need to run some code that you're writing. So that code needs to be the fastest, best optimized piece of code ever, or every request to get that data is about to get really, really slow. I haven't found that many scenarios where the retrieve or retrieve multiple plugin is really the thing people needed. Usually there was another business challenge they were trying to solve, and sort of this was the mechanism they used to inject it in there. So it's, let's have that conversation and sort of figure that out is something you should be doing with your developer. It's not to say no. It's not to say you can't do this or we should just not do that at all. It's not quite that hard and fast. But it is to say if you're going to do that, like, let's make sure we're having a perf conversation about that and we're taking special care to pay attention to that. So we want to look for that. Synchronous workflows are the same thing. You know, they're going to be triggered, not necessarily in the retrieve scenario, but they're going to be triggered with every write operation. Again, they can affect performance in a significant way. And then the last is we have to look at blocking. We've done a lot inside the product to help avoid race conditions. Show of hands here if you've heard of a race condition before. Okay. If you haven't, it sort of works like this. I need something. Roger needs something. Only one of us is going to get it, and we're going to race to see which one of us gets there first. And at the moment that one of us gets it, the second one has to stop moving until I'm done. Until I'm done doing whatever I was going to do. And I would love to visually do this, but I think you'll beat me. You do a lot more running than I do. So that's what a race condition basically is. It's the code equivalent of that. It's possible to code those scenarios yourself. Async plugins is sort of one way you can create a race condition yourself. And so all of a sudden what'll happen is you'll block for a nice long time, and eventually if that doesn't resolve itself, if someone doesn't win in the race condition, we'll just cancel one. We'll just say, you know what, enough of that, and we're going to shut one down. And they're particularly difficult problems to diagnose when we have them too, so they can also be really complicated from a supportability perspective. But this is a thing we have to look at. So where are you blocking, where are your race conditions, that sort of thing is very important to pay attention to in code. Show of hands here if you've worked with Premiere inside of Microsoft. All right, a couple of you. So our PFEs are Premiere Field Engineers. They're really good at this type of work. They have a performance review they do. They also do a code analysis review as well. So if those aren't services you've looked at from Microsoft, you want someone to talk to you about that sort of thing, this is one way you can get us to give you that advice. You're welcome. Everybody gets one. All right. So then the last is sort of we tell people, like, let's take measurement. Anyone ever have a crisis situation where you're working through at work or like something went horribly wrong and you're just about to have a bad day and you know it? Show of hands if that's you. Okay, me too. I deal with a few of those from time to time. And so what happens is usually you'll have the all hands, right? Like everyone needs to, they'll say lean in. This is what they say now, lean in. That's the new corporate speak, which is get to work is what that is. We need you all to work together, get to work, right? And what happens next? There's a conference room or a conference call, and it's going to start filling up with people, right? On average, how many people do you think are in on that? Too many, right? It's not really that they're not too many. It's that they're offering you all the wrong advice, and usually it's because they're offering you the advice without measurement first. They're just saying, well, what if it's this? What if it's this?
Do something.
Do something, right? And sort of they're understanding what they're really trying to tell you is this thing is really impactful. It matters in a huge way, and I need it solved. They should just say that and leave the room, because that would make things much easier so people can now get to work. But instead, they'll stick around for the next 2 hours until you solve the problem, right? They want to keep their eye on this.
Are you done yet? Are you done yet?
Are you done yet? Well, is this not done? If it's not done in the next 28 seconds, like someone is getting fired, and I'm bringing someone new in, right? Like that might not be the case for you. But if it is and you're feeling that, someone has to be the voice of reason in that room. Someone has to sort of walk in and say, hey, we need to take measurement. Like, we need to not guess. We need to measure. It might actually take us a little more time to measure first. But if we do that, we can actually lick this problem and in the end maybe save ourselves a bunch of time, right? Instead of having to take 16 guesses, 15 of which will be wrong, like, we can take one educated guess and have a much better chance of being successful the first time. Might take us a little longer to measure, but we'll get it right in the long run. So we got to figure out where that time is going and sort of systematically start breaking down the problem. Here's some things to do. Try it locally. Try it remotely. Try it from a bunch of different endpoints and help you weed out location-based scenarios. All right, this happens from here to here. It doesn't happen from here to here. So now all of a sudden, and I draw it out on the whiteboard, is what I do, and I start crossing things off the list. Well, it's not this one. It's not this one, and it's not this one, so it leaves me with what's left. Outside in is another way we look at this. I've helped a lot of customers, some in this room, with looking at outside in analysis of CRM. So one of the things we do is sort of say, when we test, let's not test with the assumptions that we know all the things that we're supposed to know. Let's test from the outside as if we're a consumer, as if we're anyone else who needs to look at this without all of the inside knowledge and see what experience they're having. And that's sort of a big deal to do that. Thousand Eyes, again, is sort of a good way to get the outside in analysis. They've got sort of agents all over the world at different network segments and places, and you can sort of say, hey, go do this. Go to the URL and tell me what this looks like. Try it in the vanilla org. Take your customizations out, right, of the equation and sort of say, is this a product issue? If it is, you're going to call us, and you're going to tell us that it's a product issue, I'm sure, and we're going to do something about that. So we're not just going to sit on that and say, well, okay, sorry. It doesn't work that way. But the first thing that we do when you call and do that is we do the exact same thing. We try to reproduce it on a vanilla org first. We take your scenario and say, all right, let's take all your customizations and stuff out of the equation. Can I make this failure happen the same way? I can. Yep, we got a bug. I just fast-tracked you in the world of it's a bug, right? And so then the last is sort of do some network tracing. Do the fiddler tracing. Do the analysis there and sort of, again, have the data to say, this is my choke point. This is my thing. And I'm going to say that you should do all these not just when you're in this critical situation, but also before you call our support. And the reason I say that is because it's probably the first thing we're going to ask you to do when you call our support. So you get so much more traction if you come and you've got that data in hand already. Like, your chance of getting that support case addressed while you're working with them is much higher if you've got the information that we're about to ask you for. The diagnostic tools, again, we have things we can do for you, and then what can you do for yourself? So we've talked a lot about that. Like, make sure you're taking advantage of the things we can do for you as well. If you don't know, ask us, because we probably have something that, you know, that we may or may not have made really public for you.
All right. Before jump on that one. So here's heard about Express Route. That technology people have heard about. Cool. Who here has heard of it in the context of speeding up performance? Okay. So I want to set some cautions to what I'm going to be saying today, which is I'm not here to slam ExpressRoute. ExpressRoute is a great technology. What we are seeing is that an awful lot of people are leaping onto the throwing darts approach, which is I've got a performance problem. I'm not going to do any analysis. I'm not going to dig into anything yet. But please apply the silver bullet of ExpressRoute. That's my magic ticket. Everything suddenly goes faster. It's got Express in the name, after all. That's going to solve my world, and I don't need to do anything, and I don't need to spend any time doing anything, so please switch it on. And that's what I really want to address, because we've seen a lot of expectation setting that has set people on the wrong path. It is a great technology, and it will play its part in lots of different ways, but what I want to talk to you about today is really give you a little bit more understanding about what it does do, what it will do in the context of CRM, and hopefully give you a little bit more information to understand where it will play a part, and more importantly, what part it will play in your deployment, so that you do it in an informed way rather than, I just need to tick this box and everything goes better. So first of all, let's talk about Express Route from where it started. And it started about connecting in Azure IaaS machines onto your corporate network. So in those scenarios, it's partly about compliance, and it's partly about predictable performance. But it's very much about being able to make your virtual machines domain joined and part of your private network. And in that context, it's a great technology. It does all of those things in a really great way. It lets you use machines as if they're part of your network, even though we're hosting them. And so, to be really, really clear, this as a technology is a great piece of technology. But now let's look at it from a CRM perspective. We're not domain joined. We never will be. It's shared service. Our servers are shared. They're not going to be on your domain. So that aspect doesn't really play a part. We're not going to be on your private network because, again, it's a shared cloud service. So the areas we're really looking at from a CRM perspective are going back to what we talked about earlier about compliance. What Express Route will do is give you a private connection across the internet phase of the connection. So it means that you're not sharing your data across the internet. You'll have a private connection through your ISP. And that is absolutely a place we play, or ExpressRoute will play with CRM. To a lesser extent, it also helps with predictable performance. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail afterwards. It will play a part in that. But again, it's not the silver bullet to this. And often the analogy I would say and why we started with all the other things you can do, it's a bit like having a car and putting a fuel additive in to give you 3% extra performance in your engine and not taking the trailer off the back, you know, with all the weight in it. The reality is all the other things that are in the car are hitting you long before you get to that connection. If we're getting 500 millisecond times, if we're getting proxies that are blocking or slowing down a lot of your traffic, the little bit of performance we're going to gain from the Express Route side of things is not going to suddenly magically solve all those things. This doesn't bypass all those things either, so it's not the magic solution. So to set some context of this, we absolutely play with Express Route from a compliance point of view. It will have a contributing factor to performance, but it's nowhere near the biggest ticket item compared to some of the other things we're doing. So I want to help set that expectation before we start. But for those who don't know Express Route, essentially the idea is you're in your customer network and you make a connection out originally to Azure Compute or public services. And the idea would be it would go through your network to the point you would talk to your connectivity provider, your ISP. And then you'd get a dedicated connection that would reach all the way through that network through to the edge of Microsoft's network. And then we'd have what we call a peering site, which decides within Microsoft's network where to go route that traffic to our different services. That was kind of the original principle from an IaaS perspective. And my clicker's not working. Oh, it's just taking a while. From an IaaS perspective, or from an Azure perspective, there's then two subtle sub-elements of that. The idea of public resources, which we call public peering, so Azure Web Roles, SQL Azure, anything that's kind of hosted more generally that's not your private domain. You've got your own resources within there, but the shared infrastructure is there. And then there's private peering, which is around things like Azure Virtual Machines, where it's yours. The network is yours, the whole connectivity around there, while virtual, but is very much dedicated to yourselves. What we've introduced then is the concept of Microsoft peering, which actually then takes us to the idea of starting to build in some of the other services like Office 365 and CRM. I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail, but the other side of this is to recognize what Express Route is about is providing connection to the edge of the Microsoft network. Now, we have partners in locations around the world where that can terminate, but it's not always going to be right in your network. It's not going to be right next to your branch office. So in terms of understanding and designing this, you need to understand where we've got partnerships with the network providers of where we'll terminate into the network. So if you are in Chicago and there's a connection there, great. If you're in Atlanta and you've got to route via somewhere else to get to, say, Seattle or Chicago or Dallas, then that has another impact because you're not immediately going to join locally. So that does impact on the way that you define and design this. So let's take a look at Express Route at a high level. The idea of Express Route, which often confuses people, is the perception that it will be a connection all the way from your client all the way to your CRM server. It's not. The idea of Express Route is it sits across the internet connection phase. So from the edge of your corporate network to the edge of our corporate network or our data center network. It doesn't go all the way to our server. It terminates at the edge of the network. And it terminates or starts at the edge of your network. It doesn't reach all the way through to your individual machine. It's a private connection through your internet connectivity provider. So it's important to understand that in terms of that gives you some context of what benefits or challenges it's going to address. The other part of this is that often gets lost is it doesn't prevent access through any other way. We don't block access direct to your CRM instance from outside, from the internet. That's not what this is about. This is about giving you the choice of a private connection. It's not fundamentally imposing that. And that's valuable in lots of ways, but it's something to be aware of. Unless you do something to block the access in other ways, like checking through authentication or using something like Azure AD conditional access, this itself doesn't do it. What this is about is protecting things through that tunnel that is setting up.
So I'll add something to that as well. In addition to us not blocking that, we're also not taking the IPsec encapsulation cost to make that direct connection. Yep. So from a compliance perspective, we can sort of help making sure it's there and it's secure and it is in fact encrypted, but we're not going to encrypt it again at layer two.
Yep.
So some of the network guys, they've asked us that. It was about a 30% overhead to IPsec encapsulation. So we're like, we don't really get very express with Express Route when we do that. So we don't do that part because we already encrypted it through SSL the first time.
Yeah. So the big phrase to be aware of from our side is that once you start using CRM Online or Office 365, you're using Microsoft peering. And what that is talking about is Microsoft services that are not private to you, the shared services like Office 365 and CRM. And that is the peering model, and the routing model on our side that you would start to use. So how does this actually work? This is done at a network level, and again, this is something that's often lost by people, is I switched this flag, and all of a sudden this all happens for me. Well, no, it happens at a network level, both on our side and on your side. So if I start, you're out at the client, and I'm going to talk about kind of one scenario here where you're out in a branch office where you've got a client making a connection. Express Route doesn't play at this point. Express Route isn't involved at this point. The first thing that's going to happen is that you need, within your corporate network, to route that connection to the endpoint or the entry point of Express Route. And we don't play a part in that. Your routing or your proxy connection needs to set that up to route it to the entry point into Express Route. So the first part of this is your configuration taking and determining from the Microsoft URLs that we're driving, or the IPs, routing that connection through locally to the start of the Express Route connector subnet. And that's how Express Route gets set up. You set up a subnet within your network that is connected through a PGP session all the way through back to Microsoft's network. So the next part of that is then the router setup actually in that subnet, which is setting up a BGP session through the dedicated connection through your connectivity provider. And that's the start of the Express Route piece, is maintaining and managing those BGP sessions. So this is where you tell Express Route, this is the subnet, this is the connections I want to use, and you would have resilient connections on them. One to watch for is make sure those resilient sections or sessions go across different hardware. We've had a few scenarios where the connectivity provider route them exactly the same way. So all the resilience having multiple of them kind of disappears when the same network connection, actual physical connection, breaks. So the next part of this then is what happens on the other end. Once you've configured that, from a CRM point of view, you don't need to do anything on the other end. We take care of that for you. We know that if it's a CRM traffic, where to send that. We understand the Microsoft peering elements. If it's an Office 365 traffic, where to send it. So once it gets to our side, this is our responsibility. But it's really important to recognize on the customer side, there's a whole lot of configuration work on the network side to set the route, the routing and the proxies to route that traffic into the Express Route in the first place. This clicker's really not very happy. So the other side of this is we have traffic back from Microsoft. This is actually a two-way connection. And there's a number of scenarios like connecting back to Exchange services, your Exchange server, connect back to web services for a back office system. We're actually routing that back through the private network is also really quite useful. The important part of this is any service you want to connect to has to be on a public IP, because we're, again, only doing this at a network level. So we've got no context to route that to a private kind of NATed or private address, because any one of our customers could be using that. So you can use private addresses, but they need to be behind NAT, network address translation. So we now go from the URL of your Exchange server, the URL of your service, and we do a DNS lookup against it. If we then recognize that IP as being linked to your Express Route circuit, we will route it internally to go back through your Express Route circuit. Again, though, once it gets to the other side, that's then your responsibility to route it internally on your network side. And that is something on your side. You can use NAT for the private addresses, but we will be routing it as if it's a public address on the outside. Now, the other part of this that I just, again, as a caution, is what are the costs of Express Route? And some of our people can be as at fault for this as possible. A lot of our guys will quote you the Microsoft costs of this, which is the Azure subscription cost for Express Route. Unfortunately, that's actually probably one of the smallest parts of the cost of this, because there are three parts to the cost of this typically. The biggest cost is setting up the private connection with your internet connectivity provider, which is the physical infrastructure that sits on your side and on the side connecting into the Microsoft's network and the routing between those. That's the biggest cost of this typically. Now, if you speak to a Microsoft sales guy, they can't quote you on that, so you need to be aware that you need to speak to your provider and get those costs as well. And it's per circuit. So if you do this as a touch in a minute in multiple places, you're going to do this multiple times. You've then got the Azure subscription costs, which can come in a number of models, either through a certain amount of traffic or unlimited traffic. But as I say, they're generally quite small amounts in the end of the day. For Office 365 and CRM, you do need the premium, Express Route premium as well, which isn't a major uplift from the standard one, but you do need it for a variety of reasons. But the other bit often gets missed is the time and the effort to set up your network configuration in your network itself. Now, that could just be the opportunity cost of your IT team who you're paying anyway, but are now not doing something else instead. Or it could be if you've outsourced your IT, that there's a whole load of work that, or cost that you have to pay for this particular project to set this up. So again, just bearing in mind as part of the estimation and value case judgment of this, bear in mind all those different costs, because they do add up if you're not careful. The other side of this is it's not a simple switch flicking. There's sometimes there's hardware being set up, there's setting up all that routing on your network side. It's not something you do overnight in a 5-minute job. So it's something you need to factor in from a time point of view as well. What does that mean from CRM point of view? Now, we've got lots of different type of traffic. So most of this is transparent, but just for kind of interest, there's a variety of different kind of traffic that we do. So from a customer side of things, there's the connectivity to and from exchanged from CRM to server-side sync. That works in a connection that we need to allow for. Most of the connection is browser-based or the clients making requests from your side into CRM. So the primary use is all the clients like the browser or the Outlook client or USD making requests to CRM across HTTPS. The other one can be web service requests, either from your side into CRM or from CRM plugins back into your side. So they're the primary connections we make between CRM and your network. But they're not the only things sometimes that we need to think about, at least, because there are also scenarios where within the cloud we make requests. If you're online for Office 365 as well as CRM, server-side sync might play. Now, you don't need to think about these things, but they're things we have to address and make sure are catered in there. The other side of this comes in around public or private cloud. Now, we utilize public and private cloud for many of our resources, and most of that should be transparent to you. There's a couple we've noticed lately around voice of the customer arm. But in general, we'll make that transparent to you. They will be taken care of as part of the Microsoft peering. But if you introduce something, like, for example, if you want to use voice of the customer internally, then you need to allow for that. If you've got resources you host in, say, public or private as your resources, like web services that you call, you might want those being routed across ExpressRoute as well. And you don't necessarily want them outside. So there's things like that you need to think about in terms of the way that the connectivity is done. But the other big part that often trips people up is thinking about this as, well, I've set ExpressRoute up, it's once, it's done, it's sorted. Well, if you're a smaller company, that probably is the case. You would have, say, a single environment, and you would make a connection, and you only have a single connection you need to allow for. And that's fine. That's the simple case for this. But let's look at this a little bit differently in other scenarios, which is you've got a multi-branch network, and you've got multiple branches all in the same region. You're not going to set that ExpressRoute circuit up from every single branch office. The cost and the complexity of this are not designed for this. This would typically be where your internet connection comes in, and that would typically be in this scenario from your data center, not from every individual branch. Say you're a bank and you've got five branches in Atlanta downtown alone. You wouldn't set up an ExpressRoute circuit from every single one of those branches. The cost of implication would be high, but realistically, the internet connection of that would be quite hard to do as well. So what typically occurs is you'd have the WAN connection back into your central data center, and then the ExpressRoute circuit would go from there. Why that's important, though, is as Brandon was talking, if you've got a problem in that WAN connection, and that WAN connection's slow or saturated, ExpressRoute further down the tree or down the chain isn't going to help you because the slow bit is still up front. So unless you solve that slow connection in the first place, if that's adding 300 milliseconds on every request, us making 50 down to 40 isn't going to make a huge great deal of difference. The 300 milliseconds upstream is still going to be your bigger impact. So in those scenarios, making sure that you've looked at and resolved the bigger picture items before this are going to be more important. The other side of it, though, is that if you have got some errors, you can set up multiple connections even within a single region. So if there's a good reason to do that, you know there's an environment which is close to another connection point, well, you can do that. There's nothing stopping you doing it. There's maybe cost implications and setup implications or proxy reasons that you don't want to set up your own proxies on every single exit point, but you can do that if you want to. The other angle is not all connections necessarily need ExpressRoute. We see some in particularly multinational banks where there are certain regions and certain countries where not going across the internet is a compliance conversation. It might be a slightly risk-averse interpretation of compliance regulations. I'm not actually aware of any genuine hard and fast compliance regulations about this, but we've got a number of customers who are taking a slightly risk-averse interpretation of some of the requirements and saying, I would like to do this to prevent it. But it may well be one country has that requirement, but others don't. And so it may be that it's perfectly valid for you to have some countries that route via express route and others that don't. They're quite happy, even though the data is the same, to actually not route via the express route in those countries. But again, if you want to, that's fine. And actually, typically, if you are looking at different countries, or in the US, you're talking about fundamentally different regions within the US, then routing through the WAN all the way down to the other end of the country or to a different country before you enter express route may not be the optimum point. It may well be you can get much better connection by connecting that in locally rather than taking all the WAN connection all the way down. And this is where the other side of this comes in. As I mentioned, it's very much on yourselves to set up the network connection. So from an express route point of view, that doesn't define how you get the connection back in through to the express route point. And the problem with that is that we see a lot of places, and one of the reasons we're being cautious about rolling this out is because people get this wrong. And one of the most common patterns we see is people using asymmetric routing. And the challenge here is somebody gets this wrong and sets up the connection. They set up express route. But they've then got a client, and they haven't set up the routing or the proxy correctly for that client. And that client ignores the whole idea of routing internally to get to express route and goes straight over the internet. That's fine. We're going to let it in because as far as we're concerned, there's nothing wrong with going to the internet or to our service through the internet. Many customers, that is a perfectly valid thing for them to do. So the request gets routed to Microsoft. We handle it just fine, and then we respond. The problem is if the IP of the client that made the request is one that is known to express route, as soon as we try to redirect or respond to that, we know of that IP address as something that actually is being handled through express route. So we'll respond through the fastest route to that IP address, which we know to be through the express route, which is great, right until you get to your firewall, and the firewall starts to see unsolicited packets starting throwing its direction and goes, I've got a rule that says I'm not going to allow that, so I'm going to block that request. And all of a sudden, you start to see users having what used to work now failing because express routes got in the way. Now, that can be avoided through firewall rules, or it could be avoided by just being aware that this idea of asymmetric routing is not a good idea. If you've got IP addresses that should be coming through express route, you need to make sure they are coming through express route to avoid this. And one of the sides we've seen is that by default, when you set up Microsoft peering, you set this up for CRM. If you're also using if you're also using Office 365 for Exchange or SharePoint, we're not by default going to differentiate between those two. So if you set this up wrongly for CRM, but you were using Office 365 and you break the express route setup for CRM, you broke it for Office 365 as well. And that's another reason why we're being cautious about the implications of that. We have got something in preview for express route about communities, which would let you selectively determine which resource you route via express route. But again, that's something you need to make sure you set up right. The other side, as I touch on, is the fact that you can do this and route requests for other services. So back from CRM to, say, Exchange, or back to, from CRM to other services, like a back office server, for example. And we will do that on a DNS routing, as we talked about, and route it back through the express route and back into your network. Now, one thing to watch for, though, is that we're not controlling that traffic. This is coming at an IP level from CRM itself. So, and that's a shared service. So we're not going to control to say only you can connect to that, because we don't really know what you are in that context. So this is a network routing thing. So the connection on your side needs to be controlled with an application gateway at some point to protect and control that traffic coming through. It's effectively treated as an internet gateway, even though the traffic's private, but the actual gateway itself needs to protect that only the right things are accessing those resources. And same for other services. So if you've got a web service on a back office system, it works exactly the same way. So now I'll talk about a couple of the other things. The other side of this is you don't need a separate express route connection for CRM. You can reuse express route across the same circuits for CRM, Azure, and Office 365. You can choose which you do. You can choose whether you use private peering, public peering, or Microsoft peering. You can set it up just for Microsoft peering, which would separate and say that this is only used for things like Office 365 and CRM, but not for Azure. The other side, as I mentioned, you can use communities to even restrict within that just to the service you want, but you don't need to. You can reuse this across all of them, and that's often a question we get asked. The other one we get asked quite a lot is, well, I'm making a request from CRM to Azure, to an IaaS machine. Well, does that go out across the internet? And no, now we make sure that that request does stay within the network. And even if you make a request out to a service you're hosting in Azure, we'll make sure that routing stays within the same network. But the other part of this that often comes up is about mobility. If you've got someone who's got a tablet client, and is that just something gone quiet? Hello, is that better? Hello? Is my better? Thank you. Yeah, I'll just take that one. I think the battery's just died. Thanks, Brendan. Yep. So the other side of this is that if you've got mobility clients and you go out and you take them out into a hotel, like you guys are here at a conference, for example, ExpressRoute itself isn't going to control that, isn't going to make sure that's working in any different way. That's on the device and network management to make sure the proxy's set up and the way that the routing happens routes you back into the corporate network and then across ExpressRoute, if that's what you want. And we often see that with someone who, say, forces everything for those resources to come back through VPN and then across through the ExpressRoute in, because at least at that point, it's all tunneled securely, even if it is shared through, say, the Wi-Fi here. But ExpressRoute doesn't play here. That's on your network control or your device management to do that. And touching on the outbound side, you need to make sure that that network is controlled on the way back in. So in summary, and across both of the parts, what we see is when you're connecting to CRM, connectivity to online is impacted by a lot of things. There's no one single thing that will impact that. There's no one single thing that will fix that. It's important to break this down and work and understand all the different moving parts and make sure that you've optimized those to get to the resolution you want. We do see this becoming increasingly prevalent when someone starts using cloud for the first time and their internet connection was designed for people going and looking at CNN occasionally, and it's not business critical. And now all of a sudden they start using CRM and it's a business critical application. And the fact that connectivity is a little bit slower and wasn't an issue if you're just checking the news. It is an issue if you've got somebody on the phone waiting for their response. The optimizations around that can apply in lots of places, from the client itself through to the network to the server side. I mean, the things we've talked about here are predominantly around that connection phase, the client and the connection. ExpressRoute does play a part in this, but like I say, it's very rare that's the primary thing. Most of the times we hear performance problems, it's way upstream of that, and it's much bigger issues than this. We're talking about percentages, small percentage improvements with ExpressRoute from a performance point of view, typically. And it's typically about working with your connectivity provider that they've got an optimized route through their network, which is when ExpressRoute plays from a performance point of view. More often, there's bigger issues around the proxy or the network configuration or the client configuration that would normally affect this before that. Compliance, though, is a big place where we would play with ExpressRoute in terms of making sure you're never actually on the public internet. But the caution I would leave around with ExpressRoute is if you do decide to go around that is be aware of some of those implications, the costs of them. Make sure you're aware of them. Make sure you're aware of the real expectations and what you're going to achieve around it. But also make sure that you've done the network assessment to set it up right, because we do see a lot of people getting tripped up on those problems and ending up breaking it and making it worse rather than better. But that's not to take away from the technology, it's just about making sure the technology is deployed effectively. And on that note, really open for questions. If anyone's got any questions they'd like to ask, happy for either of us to kind of dig into them. Please stand up at the mic so that we can get it on the recording as well.
Thank you for is this on? Yeah. Thank you for a good presentation. My company is we have a hybrid infrastructure, cloud and on premises. We're starting a CRM project now, and this has been scary. What you've been telling me, we were before this conference, we were sure that we're going to go for the online version in accordance with our cloud strategy. But having listened to you for this hour, I think we have to go back and assess whether we should do on-premises. What's your take on that particular decision?
So I would actually challenge that interpretation of it, because if you look at a lot of these things, I think some of these come about because it's a rich browser application in the first place, which you would have on-premise. I had exactly this situation with a Spanish customer that had LATAM branches. And when they tried using a CRM as a browser application, they ran into exactly these kind of performance challenges. And their reaction was, we're going to go on-prem.
Yeah.
And I was pretty confident from even the initial diagnostics that most of these problems were going to hit them just the same on-prem. They hadn't realized it yet, but they were going to. They were adamant, and they set it up, and they hit exactly the same problems. So the reality of this is, what we're trying to actually get across is, the reality of this is most of that isn't about cloud. This is not about cloud. What it really is about the connection time, and most of the problems hit you upstream of that in your network anyway. So I would not worry about it to that extent. What we're really saying is, the reality of moving to a browser-based distributed application is the fact that you're going to hit probably network issues more than you had with, say, a thick client application or a more local application. Cloud is the thing that just normally amplifies those things hitting you right now, but you will normally hit them in a distributed application anyway. So I wouldn't use it as a reason not to go cloud, but guess what? Even if you were going that way, you would have a better performance if you fix these things on your network anyway. And normally they're not major expensive things to do. TCP window scaling is normally a setting. A lot of these things like hashing are normally settings.
Yeah.
They're not expensive things to fix, but they'll probably find you fix lots of other things. And I worked in one other customer where we were sat there and they were having a similar conversation of, well, should we go back? And when we were sat with the users is, well, we get this really rubbish CRM performance. Our internet's rubbish too, and so's our other system, and so's Outlook, and by the way, this is rubbish as well. And it's like, well, how about if we fix the network? Your entire life's going to be improved from a connectivity point of view. It's rare this is the only one. This just generally comes to the fore once people start looking at this. And because it's cloud, stop blaming it. But the reality is most of those things were impacting your users anyway. So, no, I wouldn't hold off on it, but I would step back and look at it as a chance to actually analyze your network a little bit.
Yeah.
I hope that's reassured you a little bit.
Well, it just means that there's a lot of nitty-gritty to consider either way.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's take one or two more, and then we'll stay afterwards, too. We'll have to cut the recording. We'll stay afterwards.
So we had a situation with a client where they were on-prem, and they had complex forms and CRM chattiness and global users. And we stood up an RDS server, and that really solved most of the chattiness global problem. If we stood up an Azure RDS server co-located with CRM Online, would we have the same effect?
So the question is poor man's Edge, is what that really is, right?
Otherwise known as Kludge.
Right. Maybe. And I know that's not a great answer, but the RDP protocol itself requires sort of a different connectivity pattern. It is the ultimate chunky. It's a persistable protocol over TCP instead of HTTP, and so that's going to offer you something if your bandwidth is considerable but your latency is high. So I got lots of bandwidth, but I also have really high latency. I could see it making an impact there. But if that's not your domain, like your problem, then your results are going to vary. I'd tell you the configuration would be easy enough to test, right? Like, so this would be one of these things. It'd be like, yeah, it started on a small scale and sort of see if that works. I would probably prefer something like Edge or ExpressRoute 2 if the costs are different, the level of involvement's different as per this talk, but it's certainly an interesting scenario. So VDI has its own footprint, and sort of doing the remote app has its own footprint that's sort of heavier on bandwidth, so that's something to consider.
I'd also counter that a little bit, which is we do see good performing global implementations of this. Like I say, I've got implementations go from LATAM via the US back to EMEA with good performance. One of the reasons we mentioned the idea of APAC is that if you think of the geography to get to APAC from EMEA, it's got to route through all these different countries or route around them, and that's why it's slow. Whereas if you go from North America to APAC across the Atlantic or Pacific, there's a better connection than all the bounces of that. So we do see good solutions around this. Even things like the number of fields and form, we've done a lot of work on our side, so we're not as impacted by that now. So there's kind of was kind of squeezing that problem from both ends. I don't think you generally need to go that way anymore. I know it was a solution that was quite common kind of 5 or 6 years ago. Generally, we can get there. It's just cleaning up the more common problems impacting it, I would say, that get you to that place, though.
So let's do this. We're actually out of time for the session. For those who want to sort of go to the next one, that's fine. We'll keep the Q&A going. We can cut the recording, and we'll do like maybe one more, if that's all right. Okay, awesome. Thank you, guys.